Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
This is our discussion with Ben Burgess on his upcoming book, Give Them an Argument. This is part one of a two-part discussion.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we have professor of philosophy, author of an upcoming zero book, Give Them an Argument, and comrade Ben Burgess. Ben and I have a relationship that goes back a few years, mainly me disagreeing him from my rabid sectarian position. But we also share a love of both formal and dialectical, and we can get into the minute and often overstated differences between the two forms of logic. And we both complain often about everybody seating logic as somehow a right-wing thing. And it bothered Ben enough that he wrote a book about it and also does a series of YouTube videos on Zero Books YouTube on the topic. So, Ben, why do you feel the need to write a book about logic for the left?
Yeah, so I think that there's this really dangerous dynamic where on the one hand, a lot of right-wingers and of various kinds, but I think if you like argue about politics on social media, you're likely to run into these people, who I kind of caricature just a little bit as this sort of Ludwig von Mises loving race realist basement dwelling internet troll who just love to use the rhetoric of logic, right? You know, they use almost like a magic incantation, these phrases like logics, facts, and evidence. And they love to accuse people of logical fallacies, usually in a pretty thoughtless way. And I think then this leads to a dynamic where a lot of good-hearted leftist people sort of roll their eyes whenever they hear anybody talk about logic or logical fallacies. And I think that's dangerous for a variety of reasons. I think that one thing is that one of the things that kind of leads to is that when we're kind of get into the habit of only really responding to arguments for positions that we don't like with either mockery or moral condemnation or some combination of the two. And sometimes when I say this, people tell me that, oh, no, that's really much more of a liberal thing than, you know, a far left one. But I see plenty of this on the far left, too. One problem is that it's really bad for winning over fence sitters. Because at a certain point, you know, they get the impression that you just don't have a response to the argument. And another problem is that when inevitably legitimate tactical, strategic, or even policy disagreements come up within the left, well, if the only tools we have at our disposal are mockery and moral condemnation, then those are inevitably what we turn on each other, and then, you know, then you get left Twitter.
So, left Twitter being a particular phenomenon that I, you know what though, I tend to think that there may be an overemphasis on this being an internet phenomenon, because to me, I remember reading in the 90s amongst a lot of in zines, little zines, that, you know, over relying on logic was an attempt to derail it, derailment, and logic itself was a Western, you know, imperialist concept. And I don't think a lot of the emotive arguments that we hear are that ideologically thrown out. But I mean, that tendency's been around, I probably since the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. No, that's for sure. I mean, it's definitely exists offline. It's existed for a long time. I mean, I think, you know, left Twitter is sort of its current home base. But I certainly see it outside of that. I mean, like, I think that the, people who learn politics that way then take those habits of thought with them when they go out into, you know, activism, or, you know, when, like, arguments come up at DSA meetings or whatever. Like that's certainly, I mean, if this were something that was confined to people's behavior online, it would be annoying, but probably not quite as big a deal.
So what do you think that we on the left have misunderstood about arguments, particularly for values? Because the idea of arguing logically about values, there are a group of people who actually just find the whole premise offensive. Like, you know, that they feel that their values should be self-apparent. How do you respond to that?
I mean, I think there's probably a tangle of misunderstandings here about what we're doing when we're reasoning, you know, we're talking about logic. And one of them is, and this is where I think that kind of, you know, right-wing logic bro types defining the terms of the discourse and people on our side just making the mistake of accepting it comes in, that people have this idea that making arguments, you know, reasoning means that you're being like unemotional or that you just don't care about certain things. And that's the Ben Shapiro tagline, you know, facts don't care about your feelings. And so I think that's probably where some of this idea that if you're putting your values up for a logical debate, you're sort of debasing them, or you're retreating on something that's like really bad and really dangerous to retreat on, comes from. That, you know, people think that if you really care about something, then you shouldn't, then, you know, then maybe like you shouldn't put it up for a debate in a certain sense. I think this is probably related to what a lot of people think. You know, this is so I guess, yeah. So I guess my thought here was that that instinct is probably pretty closely related to misconception about the relationship between what I'm really interested in, which is good reasoning, and this idea that people have of what a debate is in politics. So I think where a lot of the instinct comes in that, like, for example, it's really bad to debate people with certain sorts of reactionary or vile political views is that, well, when you debate something, you're giving it a certain legitimacy, like maybe that since debate is this inherently friendly, legitimizing exercise. And so, you know, just the very act of debating maybe suggests that the truth is somewhere in between or something like that. So if you're debating some value that's important to you, you're sort of preemptively making this big concession to the other side. And I think that the two things I'd say about that are, one, that it's just not necessarily so, right? I mean, like, even when it comes to that kind of debate, you can approach that in a variety of different spirits, and you don't really have to concede anything. But two, more importantly, I think that that's a confusion between what we call debate in the context of contemporary politics and just the process of reasoning about what seems to be true and trying to use arguments to convince other people who might not already see that it's true.
Yeah, so I think a big issue there that one really has to be careful of is confusing a debate with a logical process, like you said. And that's because I think people tend to confuse debating with the spectacle of a debate, which you and I would both say almost certainly is just, you know, I hate to use this old school, like, Greek dismissal of something because the sophists were really better than, you know, the tradition. But it is mostly sophistry. Like, it's a rhetorical exercise more than a logical one.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I guess one of the things I always say about this is, don't get me wrong, I don't have a problem. In fact, I actually think that leftists should be better at rhetoric and should study those skills more than they do right now. But that's also not what I'm pushing. Right. Like, in other words, you know, it's good to be confident and quick on your feet and witty and all those things. Those are good things to be. I think, you know, humans being what they are, if you want to persuade people of things, like, you do need those skills. But that's also not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about logic, about, you know, how to reason well. And you know, once you learn that, then you can kind of worry about how to package in a rhetorically effective way.
So I'm going to start off with some of your interlocutors when I read your book. And one of the interesting things about it is the way the rhetoric of logic, or almost like the mantra of logic, is used by people who are, frankly, I mean, their premises are like barely tangibly related. My favorite one, we're going to start off with the easy fruit to pick down, and we'll get into harder ones. Jordan Peterson always talks about facts and logic, but I've read both of his books, and particularly the first one. And the logical leaps and reductive assumptions and midrashic glosses and, you know, like removal, decontextualizations that are rife in that first book. And then somehow tying that to neurobiology in the second book, but in a really, really questionable and scientifically like sketchy way, somehow that gets deemed logic. But one of the things that you point out is, for example, like if you listen to Chapo Trap House, which admittedly, you know, sages of leftist theory, they are not.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But that they just automatically grant that.
Yeah.
it's prerogative. Like they just pretty much say like, oh, well, that is logic. That's stupid. Instead of like, no, also you don't know what logic really is. like,
yeah. I mean, I think maybe to be fair to Jordan Peterson, which is not a, you know, way I start sentences very often. Mm-hmm. I think he himself doesn't really talk up the logic speak that much. I think what it is, as far as I can tell, is that I think it's just that his fans have such an overlap with all the people who do constantly use that logic-y rhetoric, that like they're just kind of on autopilot. Like, you know, if you have if you post a video about Jordan Peterson, you know, the first 10 people in the comments will be like, well, what about his argument, right? Even if he didn't give anything approaching an argument, didn't claim to, even if you spent the whole video being like, well, as far as I can tell, I think this is the argument, right? Like, it's just, you know, it's just this impulse, like, they're just like almost this Pavlovian thing, you know, that like they're so used to it because these are guys who oftentimes started out as fans of like the new atheists, you know, Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and all those people. And then they kind of, you know, migrated over to, you know, the intellectual dark web. And so then like, even, I don't think Peterson necessarily even has to talk about it that much. I think it's just that his fans like assume that that must be his thing because like they just generally associate that with everybody they don't like. And then like the guys on Chapo just kind of assume that he must be all about that because like they just sort of generally associate it with the crowd that he's in.
Yeah. There's a long history of leftists taking right wing caricatures of leftism and just inverting them by saying they're good. Like, leftists are collectivists.
Yeah,
that's bad. Yeah. No, leftists are collectivist. That's good. What are you talking about? Like, none of that's true.
Yeah, yeah. You actually read Karl Marx and the only explicit normative value he ever talks about is freedom. But you know, there are all these people running around who think that they're Marxists. You know, who think that that's like bourgeois individualism.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we could get into Marx in specific. Because there's been a lot of people who put words in the Marx's mouth. I mean, the only thing that I've ever read in Marx where he talks about aggregates is he talks about how the only way to understand history is an aggregate. But that's not the same thing as collectivity as a normative value.
That's bizarre.
So, I mean, it is bizarre. So, I mean, I feel like when we bring up this logic thing, your book really focuses on proving, at least in the first part. Now, I find your book kind of progressively written from the obvious to the kind of arcane, in that, like, it starts off with, like, hey, look, Ben Shapiro is kind of a doofus. And and you can out-argue him for real, guys. Like, it's not even that hard to, like, and we'll talk about this towards the end, like, hey, that thing where Trotsky said that dialectical logic has nothing to do with, like, Aristotelian logic, that's just wrong.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's, like, hyper-arcane inner-left stuff, but, like...
Yeah, I mean, so part of the strategy is, and I was, I thought about this a lot as I was doing it, because how much to kind of intervene in, like, intra-left arguments, since the purpose of, the purpose of the book is to try to, you know, reclaim logic for the left in two senses, right? One is to... is to show that you actually can make good arguments for left-wing positions, and that, you know, you can, and good objections to all these wacky arguments that, you know, people who like to talk about logic all the time make, but actually are really bad arguments. And so that's part of it. And then the other part of it is to kind of show that you can, is to reclaim logic, well, specifically from those people, right? From the people who, love to use logical rhetoric right now, in the sense of showing that you can do it better, and that there's, like, that there's a better way to do it. That that, you know, you should. These are tools that help you to reason better, but only if you use them in, like, a thoughtful way, and not as kind of magical talismans of, you know, I caught you. You know, that's a fallacy, right? And so part of the strategy was to kind of try to be like, okay, you know, I want to sort of, I want this to almost function, or at least in parts of it, to almost function as a, as like a introductory logic, critical thinking kind of textbook for leftists. And so, but I think that rather than trying to get too deep into the debates that, you know, leftists themselves are going to, over, you know, it's like, let's start, you know, let's kind of start with the stuff that's, you know, hey, we all agree that Ben Shapiro is full of shit, right? Well, here's a way that you could actually demonstrate it, where you're not just, like, you know, expressing a gut feeling, you know, that you're actually showing exactly what's wrong with his arguments.
So I wanted to talk about your chapter on Ben Shapiro, because I quite liked it. And one of the things you point out, and, You go to, you know, what some Marxists may call standard bourgeois analytic logic, going back to Hume. But there has been, underneath Ben Shapiro's argument, and I'm putting that in quotation marks because it's really an assertion, that that I've seen going on for a while, that tries to get rid of the is-ought distinction, which, you know, part of why you bring up Hume, that I think goes back to Sam Harris. And probably even further than that, but Sam Harris was the first person I know that really tried to, like, make a career out of this, and remarkably never got caught on it in the new atheist sphere. So, you know, he made that argument that morality was objective because medicine is a science.
Yes.
And that's not a fair characterization, but it really, the steps of the argument really was, like, medicine is a science. It follows inductive and abductive patterns. It is often unable to account for itself in a meta framework, in a metalogical framework or meta justification. Its practices are often self-confirming. This is also true in ethics. Ipso facto, ethics is objective. Like, you know.
Yeah. So I think the right, like, so yeah, Sam Harris, when he makes this argument from the analogy to health, I think that a lot of times that's actually maybe the Harris argument that people who know a little bit about this stuff are least likely to be sure what to say about. But I think increasingly, I think that what you should say about that is just that, yeah, there is an analogy here. You're just going the wrong direction with it. You know, health is a normative concept that you have that, like, it just happens. It's one that in many, maybe most cases, is a lot less controversial than ethics. But look, I think that it's probably fair to say that, you know, I mean, homosexuality used to be in the DSM, right? Yeah. That's not...
I was about to say, any DSM categorization debate, like, to me, blows up this argument.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, they're the obvious ones, like homosexuality and gender dysmorphia, as it's recently got removed.
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of ones about the precise demarcation of like sociopathy and psychopathy and schizophrenia. The first two categories aren't even in the DSM anymore. Like, you know,
and the people and actually, I think this is kind of funny because right now a lot of the people who are, you know, the biggest, you know, intellectual dark web fans, one of their little causes of the moment is getting really upset about the American Psychiatric Association's guidelines about toxic masculinity.
Yeah, I follow Skeptic Mag on woke Twitter. So
or
anti woke Twitter. Yeah, and what's, you know, as a side note, because this is not mentioned in your book, but I find that so funny because there are things to, as a scientist, to be upset about those guidelines, because they basically are so couched in fear of being condemned that they don't say anything. Like, they sound like they say something, but I was listening to two cognitive psychologists discuss it, and they're like, yeah, they kind of actually just subclause themselves into negation. Like, but no one's reading that. So, like,
yeah. And, you know, and it's not even like, but I mean, like, there's a point here that's not even just about, okay, you know, psychology is severely imperfect as a science. It's also like, you know, I don't think the fact that, you know, being gay or being trans, you know, used to be in the DSM, it's not anymore. Now, you can make a reasonable argument that maybe part of that has to do with advances in empirical knowledge, but I don't think that's most of it. I mean, I think I don't think that it's mostly that, like, that used to be the case and is not anymore because, like, as a scientific community, psychiatrists, you know, found out a bunch of new stuff about, you know, homosexuality or being trans or anything like that. I think it's mostly just that, you know, we sort of collectively decided to make a different decision about whether our conception of that portion of the good life that we label being healthy includes being, you know, being straight and cis and all that.
Well, I think this argument that you and I are making is going to make a lot of people on both on all sides, not just both. We're not going to do the excluded middle thing here. On all sides, a little bit uncomfortable because we're saying that, like, science is real and valid, but also, like, there are normative conditions you have to consider, and if you claim they're not there, you're kind of being dishonest, and particularly in psychology. But it's not just psychology. I mean, our discussions on, as disability activists will tell you, our discussions on disability have normative judgments that change, whether or not, say, deafness is treated as a separate culture or a complete disability. Mm-hmm. Like, that's been an open debate, one that's been settled amongst the deaf community, and, like, nobody really else has been following what's been going on there.
Sure.
But that's another normative judgment. Like, you know, we can still communicate deafness is no big deal. I mean, now the Ben Shapiro's of the world are going, well, that's total relativism.
Of course it's not, because they don't. It's, you know, I mean, not that this is something I follow really closely or whatever, but my understanding is that the deaf activist claim is not going to be that, like, you know, it's up to you or something, right?
Yeah.
It's that, like, there's actually going to be an objective fact that this is, you know, there's actually going to be an objective fact of the matter, you know, about how to think about this that, you know, that doesn't fit with the way that it was traditionally thought of. It's not relativism. It's just, you know, it's just rejecting the old view of what the objective fact was and just substituting a new one.
I mean, it's basically taking the objective correlative and saying, yeah, that's a fact, but the interpretive matrix that exists in socially is very different.
Relativism thing is really strange too. Like, I notice a lot of people who are hawks or even, like, you know, quote unquote foreign policy realist types, love to accuse people of relativism for saying that the United States does bad things that should be judged according to the same standards as other countries, which is, you know, one would think the opposite of relativism. There's an interesting, I think that might be another one of these words that, you know, like, people have absorbed the idea that disliking relativism makes you tough-minded. And so they kind of mindlessly apply it in this, you know, probably the same way people mindlessly apply this facts and logic language.
So another chapter in your book that I thought was brilliant, and I don't use that term lightly, is your, not attack, but your interrogation on Nate Silver and an overuse of inductive trends, where you almost sound like the left wing Tlaib almost, but you know, that you would find that insulting, but like just this overuse of inductive statistics as a predictive measure, you talk about the logical problems with that. And that's an interesting one because that is an argument that's outside of the far left. It's a centrist liberal sort of argument, but it's one that, like, let's say you're on the right-ish end of the DSA.
Yeah.
You know, that is going to be almost internal to us too. Cause there are certain kinds of pragmatic policy wonk types who are on our side, who are also given to the same misconception of induction. So you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So Nate Silver, by the way, just to give a little bit of personal background here, I went to high school with and slightly knew him in high school, not very well.
That's amusing. Anyway,
yeah. I was over at his house once. I remember that his family had a three-legged dog. You know, this is pretty much the, you know, I'm digging to the bottom of my Nate Silver knowledge. But in any case, so then, like, in 2008, when he got to be a really big deal, I mean, I got, like, really enthusiastic about him for a long time, for a little while, you know, because it was like, oh, hey, you know, this is the hometown guy made good. And even if I always had, you know, there were always signs, you didn't have to look very far for that, like, his politics were probably not great. But, you know, it seemed like what he was doing was this relatively apolitical good service where he was trying to teach people to think more carefully about use of statistical evidence, that, you know, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to put a lot of weight on any individual poll, you know, stuff like this. Right. And then by 2016, I'd soured on him for a couple of reasons, which are related to each other. One of them is political, that I think he became much more of a he became much less of a guy who would, like, write some blog posts where he made reasonable points about statistics, and more of a political pundit whose gimmick was statistics, so he had to frame everything that way. And in particular, I was super annoyed in 2016 when he started making these political points about the Democratic primary, the Hillary versus Bernie primary, which were sort of disguised as this purely statistical point. And the way the point that he always made was that he thought that the political differences between them were exaggerated, for some reason that somebody who I liked might say that, right? You know, neither of them is questioning the foundations of the capitalist order or anything like that, but because of their, if you compare their voting records during the 2 years that they were in the Senate together, they voted the same way. I don't remember anymore what it was, but it was either 88 or 93% of the time or some superficially staggering number like that. Therefore, Nate Silver, as the voice of data, declares that anybody who's making, like, a big deal about political differences between them must just be wrong. So, and I think that this is also a symptom of just what happened. Like, 538, Nate's website, I think, was a victim of its own success. That they had to, for the sake of the various contracts they had with the New York Times and the ESPN and all of that, they had to just constantly pump out content. Like, there's a by the 2016 primaries, they were literally doing things like publishing on the website the unedited chat transcripts of the editors, like watching the election results come in. And I was like, God, you know, you want to talk about the signal and the noise? You know, this is getting very, very noisy.
Yeah, their podcast output's obscene too. Like, it's just crazy, actually. Like, I tried to keep up with it for a while, but it's too much.
Yeah. And then, so, like, I think that what this inevitably leads to is that they're really just going to be doing horse race punditry that's as dumb as everybody else's horse race punditry. But they sort of feel, for the sake of their brand, like they always have to attach some little tidbit of data to it, which is really kind of maddeningly misleading. Like, what it reminds me of is on ESPN, when I first got together with Jennifer, who I'm now married to, she used to watch all these ESPN shows, and so I watched, like, over the course of that first summer, I watched, like, many more hours of these shows than I'd ever watched before. And one of them was something called Numbers Never Lie, where the format of the show was that the two hosts would, like, banter a little bit about some controversial sports topic, you know, is such and such team going to go all the way, whatever. And then they would bring out at the end of the segment some statistic that was relevant to this in some way, as if that settled the argument. I mean, I actually like the hosts. I like their subsequent show a lot more, but just the whole setup of that show used to drive me nuts. Because it's like, well, okay, if by numbers never lie, you mean you can't use pieces of statistical information in possibly misleading ways when you only, like, bring out one little nugget of information at the time? Of course they can. This thing about Hillary and Bernie having voted together in the Senate, 93% of the same time or whatever it was, is very much like that, because for one thing, you're looking at this tiny little piece. Both of these people have, in one form or another, political careers going back to the early 80s or earlier. In Bernie's case, he was in Congress, elected to Congress the first time, I believe, in 88 or 90. And even in Hillary's case, she was elected to the Senate several years before he was. So there, so a lot of this piece of this nugget of information becomes really misleading when you start looking at, oh, hold on. So, like, the Iraq War, they voted different ways on that, but that doesn't count because he wasn't in the Senate yet. The Patriot Act, they voted different ways on that. That doesn't count. NAFTA, Patriot Act reauthorizations, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But my favorite part of this is that beyond the fact that there's this long list of really important votes that aren't counted because they weren't in the Senate at the same time, beyond the fact that it's this absurdly small sample size. But my favorite thing about this is that during those 2 years that they were both in the Senate, Hillary Clinton was running for president. So presidential candidates miss a lot of votes.
Right.
So the idea that this 2 year stretch is what you're looking at to try to decide whether these, as like some sort of meaningful metric of political similarity, even if we pretended that all votes are equally important, which of course they're not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is just nuts. It makes no sense at all. And I think that there's I guess the last thing I'd say about this is I think there is a particularly dangerous thing here, which is that in a way, the Nate Silver, I'm not doing punditry, I'm just telling you about data thing, is almost like a centrist liberal version of facts don't care about your feelings. That in it's different, but it's in both cases, I think there's a fundamental confusion about the difference between the relationship between factual information and moral and political goals, that we can't that, you know, factual expertise is great once we already have the same goals, and, you know, factual expertise can tell us all kinds of things about achieving those goals, but when there's a kind of technocratic liberalism that Nate has unfortunately become a really good example of, that seems to just erase that distinction. That the idea just seems to be that once we all have enough expertise, then political disagreements will just sort of go away.
Yeah, the pragmatic technocracy. I mean, not to say the far left isn't given to this. Organic centralism and verdigism actually is a parallel. I'm going to not make people mad by saying they're the same, but it's close. So, like, we aren't immune to it. But, yeah. This brings me, though, to something that I kind of... It doesn't come up in your book because I think you wanted to avoid... not avoid, but and maybe I'm putting stuff in your mouth. But I think some of the intra-left controversies that we deal with, you did mostly steer clear of, except for the arcane one I mentioned about Trotsky that I'll talk to you about in a minute. But there's a set of heuristics that we have on the left that gets reduced down to jargon, both on radical liberal and in, say, the Marxist left, that the jargon can often lose the fact that it's an analogy for an actual substantive argument. My one, for example, is that I bring up all the time is the misuse of privilege theory. So privilege theory it's an elaborate but quick metaphor for understanding both cultural and wealth inequities inherited over time that don't depend on implicit bias or explicit bigotry, right?
Okay,
like it's kind of the I've gone through the history of it. It starts with W.E.B. Du Bois' Wages of Whiteness, gets brought out in the 50s and with white skin privilege, and then becomes white privilege, and then gets talked about as privilege. And that there is an argument there that has some sociological and logical validity. What happens over time, though, is it gets used not as a kind of explanatory metaphor, which, like, when Peggy McIntosh, the person who really popularized what we know of it, came up with it, was trying to do. It was like a pedagogical tool. And it gets substituted as an explanation, which thus makes it a circular argument. So, like... why am I privileged? Because you're privileged.
I mean, I think, I don't know. My understanding is that when W.B. Du Bois was talking about psychological wages of whiteness, that his original point there was that this is kind of fool's gold, right? You know, that this is a way of tricking white workers into not understanding their common interests with black workers.
Yeah, I mean, that was also the point of white skin privilege, too, that it was the theory is, like, if we can give you someone to look down on so you won't notice your class position because there's someone beneath you. Which, that's not exactly a logical argument, but it seems like a psychologically and sociologically fairly valid and astute observation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know you're going somewhere with this, but just real quickly, my big problem with a lot of the ways people use privilege talk. Well, okay, one, some of the actual classic lists of privileges. Like if you look at that that essay, right? The invisible knapsack.
Yeah, I've taught it several times, and some of those things have nothing to do with skin color.
Yeah, and some of them are just bizarre. Like it's a white privilege that you can walk into a record store and you'll see music of your own race represented. I mean, that's what kind of horrible alternate reality are they living in, where where black American music was ever not represented in a record store? But I was gonna say more substantively though, aside from those wacky examples, I think usually when people use privilege speak, they are identifying a real thing that more or less lines up with what you just said. But my kind of simple-minded objection is that I worry that it really puts the foot in the wrong shoe, right? Because oftentimes when people give more reasonable privilege lists, they're saying I can walk into a store without being followed around and suspected trying to steal things, etc. And it seems like there's this weird thing that we do where where people are so used to talking that way that they end up defining just sort of being treated with a reasonable amount of human dignity as a privilege. And that seems like a funny way to talk. Like,
right.
I think that it might be, I mean, I wonder how much of that is just because the word oppression seems sort of old fashioned and, you know, new lefty, that like people prefer privilege.
Yeah. I pick up from Eric Olin Wright, the late, unfortunately, very recently late Eric Olin Wright on this, where I separate oppression, domination, and exploitation as separate categories and like strictly delineate them. And like, everybody's like, why? But, you know, I could get into why I do that. This is part of the reason why, is because this privilege talk often, I think if you see it, its original purpose was a pedagogical tool.
Yeah.
At this point, it's not a very good one, because people automatically go, you know, and I've taught this list to students, so I know they do this. I'm white and I can't do some of this either. You know,
I mean, plus it's just kind of funny. Like, I even see things like, you know, oh, see that guy who was in an armed confrontation with the cops and he ended up living through the experience? That's white privilege. That, like, it almost seems like there's this implication that it would have been better and more just had that guy been shot.
I've actually heard, one of the arguments that was made by Toni Morrison actually is, when white kids get shot, you can talk to me about it. And then somebody just immediately, you know, on that article, right winger, posted the list of all the unarmed white kids who have been shot, which there are a lot of. There's just not anywhere near the proportion there are of black male kids who have been shot. But those kind of hyperbolic statements seem justified in that framework. So my point of bringing this up is, I think these are heuristics. Some of them, I think, are more flawed than this. Like, when we talk about cultural appropriation, I don't think anybody really knows what they mean. Because everybody's got arbitrary dividing lines of what they think is okay and not okay. But there's a lot of these heuristics that are not very fine-toothed, and we use them as arguments, and then we teach them as an interpretive framework matrix that is automatically true, and they're actually really bad substitutes for arguments. Another one that drives me up the wall, that's popular on the liberal left and to some degree the far left, is all the lived experience talk, because it conflates qualia and I'm gonna get into real technical logic language, and not in the Marxist sense. We're getting Aristotelian here for a second. It conflates qualia and quanta. So, like, the fact that your experience of racism should be taken as valid does not mean the objective correlative that someone intended to be racist towards you is the same thing. Yes, those people should listen to you, but they're listening to your qualia and has to validate your qualia. It is not the same thing as saying that you understand their intentions. I mean, we can't know anyone's intentions for real anyway. So in some way this becomes a weird metaphysical argument, but it goes into a place that you could just avoid by saying you understand if someone feels like something is racist, that they might have a legitimate reason for feeling like something is racist, which seems like a very different thing to say than you have to accept the lived experience of other people.
Yeah, well, and especially I think lately I feel like I've been seeing a lot of instances just in the last little while of right-wingers learning how to co-opt this strategy. The two examples that come to mind are, if you're opposed to the coup in Venezuela, you're told to, you know, listen to Venezuelan. And also, part of this is just this somebody who will remain nameless who I follow on social media who's very fond of this argument. So maybe I've just been seeing it more lately, which is this sort of way that left-wing advocacy on Palestine is delegitimized by using all of the standard woke language about how, you know, Jews should get to define anti-Semitism, etc.
Yeah. Oh, that's the funny thing is, like, we should have seen that coming, because it's happened several times. Whenever the left gets into these subjectivist arguments, they're almost always used against us immediately. I mean, like, there's a history of this going back 100 years. So, like, the umbrage taking tactics, you know, that was part of, say, you know, community building and consciousness raising. The right wing used it in the 80s. Like, they used to, like, Reagan literally did use Saul Alkalinsky's book as part of his campaign program. Like, like, that's not, I'm not making that up. Like, so yeah, there's a history there. And that subjectivist standpoint can be, is easily turned on you, which is one of the reasons where, besides, like, an insistent and, like, basic, even bourgeois freedom is actually a good thing, that... Yeah. That a deeperness is like this, just, or maybe a more, maybe it's not deeper, it's actually more superficial, but like most of this stuff is tactically stupid. It actually is granting ground that you don't think you're granting. But I've gone through this history, for example, like human biodiversities are obviously racist, right? But it's actually a co-option of a left-wing argument. The first person who talked about it was talking about, you know, maintaining cultural diversity in anthropology, and he thought he was, you know, making an argument as an analogy to the way we want to preserve biodiversity is preserving cultural diversity. And then it almost immediately got co-opted by the right wing. Like, this was in the 80s. And that anthropologist, I forget his name right now, is one of the people who talks about how human biodiversity is wrong, but it was something that was easily co-opted because it interjected something well-meaning but nebulous into the discourse it was easy to take. And so a lot of these heuristics, to me, they're kind of not just logically they're logically fallacious when employed wrong. Like any kind of heuristic can be, right? We use heuristics for a reason, right? Because we don't always have time to go through the, like the Aristotelian of syllogisms for everything and go through our modal sets, you know.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, right, the problem with being with the, you know, Stefan Molyneux thing where you pretend that pointing out that something's not an argument is a really damning point, is that that itself is not an argument, as are 99.9% of human speech acts. You know, it would be really weird if... You know, we were doing nothing but giving arguments all the time, and there's an obvious infinite regress problem, right? You know, because if you're, the point of an argument is to, you know, if an argument just is justifying a conclusion on the basis of something, you know, that people are more likely to believe than they already believe, you know, that they're more likely than they are to believe the conclusion itself, then, you know, unless reality is cooperative enough to give you a series of increasingly more and more obvious things, you do have to stop somewhere.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.